Welcome to The Point on WCAI. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Sean Corcoran. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Paul Pronovost. He's the editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Sean.
And welcome back. We haven't seen you in a few months.
I know. It's good to be back.
And of course, he shows up with very little notes, which always amazes me.
Well, it might be a disaster. We'll see.
It's okay. And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Both of our islands will be represented today with Joshua Balling calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we'll hear from Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll also speak with Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner. Let's take a look here at the news on the Cape and Islands. This morning's paper, Paul, front page, contaminant found in school's water. We're talking about East Ham Elementary School and a town that's been dealing with a contaminant in its water and what exactly to do with it.
Right, and I think that this headline probably could be a tipping point for the town of East Ham. Of course, they've been talking about contaminants in the water for some time. This goes back to a landfill that was not capped properly, and so there have been contaminants leaking. They've affected the groundwater for a while, particularly a neighborhood around the landfill, and has led to a town-wide discussion and really pretty sometimes vicious debate over what to do about it. There's been discussions and defeats of initiatives to have a public water system put in place in East Ham. It's the only community on the Cape that doesn't have that. So that has been sort of in the backdrop. Now, as they continue to map where these contaminants are going, the fact that contaminants have been found in the water at an East Ham elementary school is particularly bad news. The kids are going to be getting bottled water, but as you can imagine, it sort of raises the stakes of this debate, and we'll have to see what it means as we head into town meeting season. More proposals heading probably to the floor of town meeting, and you can imagine folks will have a new level of anxiety related to this with this latest development.
It sounds like it's a pretty small amount that they're finding it in the water. And of course, that's what officials are saying. It's a smaller amount, not to worry, but any amount is too much. So we're going to be providing bottled water. But that small amount has been part of this debate all along.
Yeah.
People are kind of doing a cost-benefit analysis in their heads and determining how they're going to vote, whether they're going to vote to provide actual town water or not. Because they say, well, if it's such a small amount, the odds are 1 in 1 million, I think was a quote in the story at one point, that someone could actually get cancer.
And of course, that's always the debate when it comes to either cleanup or providing any sort of public service. Going back to Boston Harbor, when they were cleaning Boston Harbor, the big question at the time was, how clean is clean enough? You know, and you do reach that point of cost-benefit analysis. Same closer to home at the Massachusetts Military Reservation,
sure,
where they've been doing cleaning. And here, that's the case as well, where the trace amounts have not been considered a health concern, nothing to really sound alarms. But that's, frankly, in the political scheme of things, hard to convince a mom whose kid is going to that elementary school that they're not going to be the 1 in 1 million. And when you look at the elevated rates of cancer and other things here on the Cape, folks have a heightened vigilance about that. And it echoes throughout our discussions and debates on all sorts of matters, from things at the MMR to NSTAR herbicide spraying. And I think that all ties into this particular thing. So you're absolutely right. The amounts are fairly low, but the fact is there is a debate.
Absolutely there is. And you make a good point about the parents. They're going to get loud about this,
sure,
I would imagine. And you said it looks like the selectmen have come up with yet another water plan. This is what they're calling kind of a backbone water system. That's going to be for about $41 million. So going back to town meeting, and as you indicated earlier, those town meeting debates have been raucous and very close in terms of the votes themselves. So there certainly are a fair number of people in town who are saying, we got to address this now.
Right. And last year's vote was on a system-wide plan done in stages. I can't remember what it would cost, but I think it tipped in the hundred of millions.
Mm.
And it was big, big money. It was defeated very narrowly. The year before, they put a proposal together. And to be honest, the selectmen and town officials really didn't have their game plan together leading into town meeting. They had a proposal. Then they got blowback from the community. So they came to town meeting with a smaller proposal. It led to a lot of confusion. That one was defeated soundly. So there seems to be some feeling of something needs to be done. A lot of the debate centers on where it should be done. Should the entire town of East Ham get public water, or should it be certain areas and particular areas around these contaminants? And I think that, as you said, is going to be what they're looking at when they come to town meeting this spring.
Let's move on to another surprising story this week. We learned about the layoff of 11 teachers at the Dennis Yarmouth School District. We saw a lot of this, Paul, in 2008, 2009, communities were laying off educators left and right. This was kind of a surprise, but what was behind it isn't.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, the fact that there were layoffs in the middle of the school year is shocking. This just simply doesn't happen. Layoffs are not new. School layoffs are not new. And as you said, what's behind it is not particularly new. Carol Woodbury this week discussed what amounted to 30 positions in total, including a variety of teaching positions, assistants, lunchroom monitors and the like, centering a lot on special education. A lot of special education assistants lost their positions. And the school still has many, but what is concerning the parents the most are special needs parents who their kids had one-on-one attention, and now perhaps when they come out of February vacation, they won't have one-on-one attention. So that was a lot of the discussion the other day when Carol Woodbury met with parents and sort of a hastily called meeting. All of this happened. It was a shock to many people in the community and even some school committee members. It was discussed last Thursday at a school committee meeting. Friday, the layoffs happened. That's the day before February vacation, and parents started to hear about it, frankly, largely through the Cape Cod Times on Sunday published a story, and there were some other notifications, but that's when people really started to get worked up, complained to the schools, wanted to know what happened, and Woodbury called them together. As she explains it, a lot of this has to do with what any school administrator in the Commonwealth knows, and probably across the country, the budget buster of special education costs. And this year, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts gave the DY school district about $400,000 to cover special needs costs. Normally, they give about $1 million, so it was a significantly lower amount. One residential placement for special needs is about $200,000. So you can imagine, if you have 400, one person in the most extreme case is $200,000, you're going to run out of money very quickly. And that's what they did. They had hoped that they could get through the school year before taking any action. It didn't happen. And now they're in this bind. And it's been rippling this week. Definitely next week, as the kids go back to school and the dust settles and people realize the full impact of what has happened, I think you're going to be hearing more about this.
Okay. Also in the papers this week, quite a number of stories about the addiction issue that the Cape Cod Times has been covering for several years now here on the Cape, the islands, and the South Coast. Three different stories that I made note of. One about the addiction, the overdose statistics that the state retains. Another about a new mix of drugs here, and then a positive story and an awful issue about some efforts to really fight these drugs. Let's start with this lethal mix of drugs. What are they talking about? No, we know heroin is back.
Right, heroin is back and has been back for some time.
That's
it's a
right.
trend line, unfortunately, that is not going down. There is this chemical called fentanyl, which is about 40 times more powerful than heroin, and it can either be administered on its own or mixed with heroin. And because it is so strong, it is lethal. And not that heroin is not, but fentanyl drives up the overdose rates in an extraordinary fashion. Some places like Rhode Island saw in January a huge spike related to fentanyl-laced heroin in the state. Here in Massachusetts, and specifically on the Cape, the Mass Police will not confirm that fentanyl is out there, but people who are in touch, human service agencies, with actual drug users say absolutely that's what's happening. They're seeing it, and the results are unbelievable. I think one fire chief told our reporter Casey Myers they're seeing an overdose a day right now, and it's scary because we know there's drug use out there. To have something that's only going to make the situation worse is literally life-threatening. And human service agencies here on the Cape, churches, fire departments, police departments, and others are scrambling to try to deal with this. And one thing they want to do is simply get the word out there that, you know, the so-called bad batch of heroin, if you will, is out there, and people should be simply aware of that and take precautions.
let's review how this is happening, and this has been covered many times over the past decade, but it's important. It seems to be starting with the prescription pills, and if we're talking about a young person, they're trying different things, it doesn't matter age. So someone gets a hold of these prescription pills, an opiate, can be highly addictive if they're not, certainly, especially if they're not used in the right way, if they're crushed or something, to get an instant type of high. People getting addicted to these, they become dope sick when they don't get them. When they become too expensive or they're unavailable, they become sick. To relieve that sickness, people are turning to heroin, which is now so potent, you don't have to put it in your arm anymore. You can sniff it up your nose, and that's what's happening. And that has seemed to have driven this whole scourge. Folks are picking up on it. We saw that, I mean, we've been reporting on this for about a decade, right? So we heard about a Senate committee being formed this week. But I was interested in the story that you had in the Cape Cod Times about the statistics, the overdose statistics. Right. One way you gauge what's happening in your community is by looking at how many people are dying from these drugs. But it sounds like the information is years old.
Yeah, and this is a great story because it speaks to a real problem that those trying to deal with the drug crisis are facing. So in some states, your information is almost exactly up to date. In Vermont, for example, they issue, I think, monthly statistics on overdose rates and other drug-related incidents. The governor of Vermont made it his centerpiece item in the State of the State address this year to talk about opiate addiction. And I would imagine largely because they can see very clearly, right up to the present time, what the trend lines are. And the trend lines aren't good. Contrast that with what we have here in Massachusetts, which is data that is two, sometimes even longer, years old. And, you know, the folks who are on the ground, the aid support group, fire departments, police departments, they know what's happening, but they don't have the data to demonstrate it. They have sort of almost anecdotal data. And it dates back to the sort of antiquated way that the Department of Public Health takes records. It begins with literally paper records of death certificates, and then they enter it into a system. And by the time they actually process that data, it's more than a year old. And as a result, we're looking at data here in 2014, 2010, 2011. That's as fresh at the numbers as we can get. So folks are pretty sure that the statistics have only gotten worse. They just can't prove it. And when you can't prove it, it makes it very hard to get any traction to deal with it.
So we heard this week from some organizations who are turning up the fight against the against these particular drugs. And what's happening there?
So the previous two stories we talked about would be the bad news, obviously. This is definitely the good news.
Yep.
A group called the Cape Cod Regional Substance Abuse Preventative Initiative, which is a mouthful, has come together and is looking to fight this crisis. And what's noteworthy is who's involved. Folks from some of the biggest agencies on Cape Cod, definitely community leaders, and folks who have money have come together to try to do this. So, for example, the Kelly Foundation, the Jane and Palmer Davenport Foundation, they have come together with Cape Cod Healthcare and others, put about $500,000 in a pot and said, that's our seed money. Let's get going. Let's address this problem. So this past week, the editorial board of the Cape Cod Times met with this group. And as I watched the folks come in the room, DeWitt Davenport, Joel Kroll, mm-hmm. Mike Law from Cape Cod Healthcare, Ray Tomasi from Gosnold, these are heavy, heavy hitters. And the fact that they've come together is pretty historic. And in fact, Ray Tomasi even said that. He's been in the prevention and abuse business for a very long time. He said it's so refreshing to finally be in a room with more than just himself or a few members of his staff, but rather community members. And they're committed to addressing this, and it's a great first start.
And of course, you need to mention, it's not only the addicts themselves, their families and friends who are affected by this, but I certainly think there's an argument to be made that home break-ins increase, petty crimes increase as you have a larger population of addicted people desperate to get their hands on money so they can get drugs.
Absolutely true. And in fact, Joel Kroll made this great point. He is the president of the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod and the Kelly Foundation, and they were looking at how they should allocate their resources to needs on the Cape a couple years ago. And they talked about things from homelessness to crime to youth issues. And someone stepped back in that room and said, you know what relates to all of this? Drug use. and we need to deal with drug use at its root. Let's snip it. They want, their goal is to have kids think of drugs in the same way kids today think of cigarettes, as an absolutely non-starter.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is going to join us. We're going to be talking about flood maps. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Paul Pronovo, the editor of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Tim, Paul, and I were just about to talk about the fact that the House of Representatives down in Congress is actually going to take up this flood insurance bill. This has been a big story around here, as these new flood maps put out by FEMA are putting many more houses into flood zones, and we're expecting insurance rates to skyrocket. Just real quick, Paul, so the Senate already passed something, and now the House is going to take it up, and what are we hoping the result will be here? A suspension, or... what are we looking at?
Well, I mean, in I think the best case scenario for folks around the Cape and the islands, it would mean a delay in the implementation of the Biggert Waters Act, which is basically a flood insurance reform, if you will, of 4 years. And that would be good news for folks around here, because the idea of Biggert Waters is a good thing. They're looking to better identify the people who are at risk on the coast and essentially assess them related to their risk. The reality has been, at least from what folks see around here, is that folks who frankly will never really be at risk are now falling within the flood zones. And more philosophically around here, folks say, okay, this is partly to address a $24 billion deficit in the National Flood Insurance Program. Mm-hmm. That's fine, but that's because of Florida, Louisiana, Texas. And while the Cape is vulnerable, should they be sharing an equal burden in paying back that deficit? That's an open question, and I think that's what they're looking to work out. So the Senate passed it, moves to the House next week.
Tim, the Cape Cod Chronicle this week, your paper has on-the-ground local reporting on this issue, and it looks like another result will be that more properties will be under conservation jurisdiction.
That's right. In Chatham, the flood zone is tied to the Conservancy District, which is the area along the shore or adjacent to wetlands that's under the jurisdiction of the Conservation Commission. So under the new flood maps, that area is going to increase because the flood maps have to be adapted into the zoning bylaw. And when this happens, Chatham also has this quirky thing where the Conservation Commission has jurisdiction within 100 feet of the edge of the flood zone. And 50 feet, the first 50 feet of that is called a no-disturb zone, where nothing's supposed to happen. And as you mentioned, a lot more properties are going to be included under these new expanded flood zone maps. It's leading to some interesting situations, according to some folks here, where... you know, for instance, in downtown Chatham, the actual edge of the flood zone comes to the rear of the parking lot where the new Chatham Orpheum Theater is, because it's pretty close to Oyster Pond. 100 feet from that puts the entire jurisdiction of the Conservation Commission on the other side of Main Street. So that would, there are some who are worried that this is almost a jurisdictional grab by the Conservation Commission. And there's a private group that formed in town here to... sponsor a town meeting petition to sort of decouple the zoning maps from that conservancy district, or at least the new zoning maps. Now, town meeting is scheduled to vote on adopting those new new flood maps in May. Not sure how the federal legislation is going to affect that. Our information was that is mostly related to the new rates, the new flood insurance rates. Not as much to do with the maps, but I think there's a little gray area there. But these citizens are going ahead collecting names on a petition to get that article on town meeting warrant.
Yeah, you mentioned town meeting, of course, and every community has to vote at town meeting, or if you have we don't have them here, but a city council or such would have to approve these, accept these new maps. And you would think that would be an opportunity to reject these new maps and not go down this road. But in fact, it seems like the reporting of Brian Morris has done for WCAI that you're pretty much compelled to adopt them. If you don't, you get nothing from FEMA.
If you don't adopt these maps, you not only lose any sort of disaster aid or flood aid that the towns might be eligible for in case of a major storm here. Local property owners who are within the flood zone and have flood insurance can lose discounts that they have. In Chatham, they get up to a 10% discount because of various steps the town has taken, including adopting these maps. And people who, I believe, the way it works is that you won't be able to get new flood insurance either, and even people who have it could lose it. And in that case, banks aren't going to touch mortgages. It could have a real impact on the real estate market, not just in Chatham here, but throughout the Cape.
Sure. I think this is a huge issue on the Cape right now, and I think it's going to be a real wake-up call when some people who haven't gone to their town halls to take a look at where their property is discover that they are suddenly in a flood zone when it's inconceivable to them that they could possibly be there. Let's move on to another story in the Cape Cod Chronicle this week. Cape Cod Tech, I like this story, boasts the highest graduation rate in the region, and I guess that's a real turnaround for this school.
It's a turnaround, and it's a turnaround in general for tech schools. There was a time when tech schools were kind of a depository for unmotivated or troubled kids, and that's not the case anymore. Students want to go to Cape Tech because it has these great trade programs where you can learn a really marketable skill. And Cape Tech has taken this seriously, and the school has increased its graduation rate from 85% in 2012, which is just a couple years ago, to 95.6% last year. That's a higher rate than, I think, almost any other school on the Cape. Not sure if it's every school, but it's higher than Nauset or Sturgis, both of which are really prestigious high schools. And also, 100% of Tech grads, we've learned, met the Mass Core basic curriculum requirements for the state. And that's even though the school has kind of a disproportionate number of special needs kids. They tend to have more than the average high school. Hmm. Now, Tech officials are attributing this success, at least in part, to a federally funded program called Graduate to Success, which identifies seniors most in danger of not graduating and works one-on-one with them to keep them in school. And kind of one of the upshots of this whole thing, I think one of the reasons that Tech officials really wanted to get this information out there is that they are going to be going to the local towns over the next few years looking for support to kind of shore up the school's infrastructure. It's a 40-year-old school. It has a lot of structural needs right now, as one of the officials there told us. It doesn't look like it because the kids who are in the trade programs actually work on the school building and keep it in pretty good shape. But, 40 years is a long time for a school building to go, and they still have the original windows, so they're going to be looking for some funding in the next few years. And they're kind of putting their best foot forward here and say, look, we're a real asset to the community, and we deserve some input, some financial help from the local communities to keep our infrastructure going.
Right. Excellent reporting in the Cape Cod Chronicle this week. Tim Wood is the editor. You can follow Tim Wood and the Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Tim, as usual, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
You too. Let's talk quickly, Paul, because we can't talk too long about this because it comes up every single week, and that would be these winter storms that we've been having. We had a few more this week. That the Saturday Sunday storm is really the big one. That a lot of power outages, right?
Yeah, and I think that's, of course, for folks what really matters. I mean, we've had a lot of weather this winter, and it's not been pleasant. It's been kind of a brutal winter, actually. But this past weekend with the power outs for, I think, 35,000 people throughout Massachusetts, and including the heart was here on the Cape because we had that heavy, wet snow. Fortunately, the winds weren't quite as bad as they anticipated, so not maybe as many power outages as they thought. And NSTAR got the power back very quickly. But that is that's the thing that really gets people. That and the ice, I think. Slipping and falling is a real concern this time of the year. So, fortunately, the snowbirds are smart enough to get out of here, and the rest of us will just have to keep shoveling.
I keep waiting to hear at the selectman level more discussions about burying utilities, speaking with the utility companies to talk about every time there's some sort of road project or sidewalk project, can we use this as an opportunity to start putting more utilities underground because these storms are not going to stop. But so far, I don't think that that's been picked up as much as it probably should be by local officials.
Yeah, I think it's the cost issue.
It is. It's a cost thing.
It's in the billions, and considering all the other more pressing things such as wastewater we have to deal with. Although it's interesting, Cynthia Stead wrote a column for the Cape Cod Times this week addressing this issue, and one of the things she talked about was, why does it have to be either attached to, you know, the telephone poles for wires or buried? Isn't there a middle ground? Can we put some sort of tubes or something along the side of the road, which wouldn't carry nearly the same cost?
Sure, innovation, huh?
You know, what the heck? Let's see if we can find something.
Well, someone should be looking at this or continue to look at this.
Besides Cynthia Stead.
Other communities have done it. I've covered them. And yes, it's expensive. Yeah. But and typically it was communities that did it for beautification purposes.
Right, right.
Let's go to the phones again. Sally Rose is joining us. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sean.
Welcome back. Talk about what's happening with the Outer Cape Medical Clinic and medical marijuana.
Well, I think a lot of towns are sort of dealing with this, and it's interesting as the realities of legalized medical marijuana sort of filter through the health center on the Outer Cape. It's having to figure out its new policies in that realm, just like a lot of other places, facilities. So they made an announcement recently, Sean, that has frustrated some of its patients. Interestingly, though, I think the health center itself is somewhat frustrated by it as well. So despite the state law that allows doctors to issue medical marijuana certificates to patients who could benefit from them, from the drug, Outer Cape Health Services just recently announced that its physicians won't be able to give them out. We spoke to the health center's medical director, that's Dr. Barbara Prazak, and she told us they were all set to roll out medical marijuana regulations, but that after talking with Mass League of Community Health Centers, they decided it was best to rethink that approach. The problem is that the distribution and use of marijuana is still it's still a federal offense, and the community health centers get federal funds that they don't want to lose. So Outer Cape Health Services, it has clinics in Provincetown, Wellfleet, and Harwich. It gets about $1 million of its $14 million budget from federal sources. That's about 7%. Hmm. Interestingly, though, I also spoke with someone that I know in California who runs a community health center there, and she said most of the community health centers there also don't issue the certificates for that same reason, even though medical marijuana has been legal there since the mid-1990s.
Wow.
And Prazak also told us that she's hoping the federal law will change soon, so that the Outer Cape health policies can change as well.
It's an interesting thing. Even as the federal government puts out reports that they're not going to clamp down on states with medical marijuana, even recreational marijuana, there was recently, I think in the just few weeks, some regulations or some guidance put out to banks.
Right, banks, yes.
Yeah, indicating they weren't going to come in and shut banks down for taking deposits from medical marijuana dispensaries. But that doesn't seem to be putting many people at ease, as you're indicating here.
Right, and I guess it's going to take either the government doing the same thing essentially for community health centers, saying they won't prosecute them or they won't, you know, yank funding from them if they do it. You know, we'll see if that happens or whether it just takes the law changing on the federal level.
Understood. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you, Sally. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. Paul Pronovo is with me here in our Woods Hole studio. Paul's really interesting story about what's called a ghost bike on the front page of today's Cape Cod Times. Talk about this ghost bike and what that is about.
Well, there was a fatal accident this past summer, bicyclists struck by a car, and as has been the case across the country, there was a ghost bike placed as a memorial to this incident. This is something that's happened across the country. It was there for a little while. It got a lot of attention. Some argued it was distracting for motorists going by.
What does it look like?
Well, it looks like a typical bike. It's white.
But white. It's painted white.
It's painted white. It sits on the side of the road, and it's fairly, frankly, it was fairly prominent right from Route 6. So a regular sized bike, painted white, and it looked much like as described, a ghost bike.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, transportation officials took it down, said it's too distracting. We can't have accidents caused as a result. Well, now there's a movement to bring it back. A lot of folks believe very strongly that it's a memorial that should stand. It's something that has been in other places without any incident, and they are making a big push to bring it back. It'll be very interesting to see what happens because, of course, and we've talked a little bit about this, there are memorials all over the place, certainly here on the Cape and the Islands as well. You know, perhaps most notably, right as you go over the Sagamore Bridge, there's a flower memorial that is rotated on a consistent basis. So, you know, the fact that memorials exist is something that happens. Should this happen here? Well, we'll have to find out.
Right. And I think in the story, it reports that it's a little unclear exactly who took down the bike. So they're trying to find out. But the point is, they're trying to get official permission to keep it there so it doesn't disappear, whether it's an official or...
It's a good point. It possibly was not transportation officials, maybe a private person, but as you point out, they didn't have permission in the first place. They feel like they need to get something sanctioned in order to be in place.
Sure.
And it, frankly, it made me think, who else has, quote, permission to do that? I mean, I mentioned the Sagamore Bridge.
Yep.
I don't know who does that. Maybe someone does. Are they getting permission to put that memorial up? I have no idea.
Yeah. It's an interesting story. Let's go to the phone again. Josh Balling is joining us. He's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at that paper. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. So the election field is set on Nantucket?
It is. The April 15th annual town election field has been set. There are going to be two contested races this year, one for Board of Selectmen, where there are two seats up, and one for Land Bank Commission, where there is one seat up. Running for the Board of Selectmen are incumbents Rick Atherton and Bob DaCosta, and they're going to square off against political newcomer Adam Reed, a 30-year-old young man and who started a nonprofit out here, and former candidate Clifford Williams, who works for the Federal Aviation Administration out at the airport, is a member of the Finance Committee and has run a number of times unsuccessfully. In the land bank, we'll see a race between Gene Casey Miller, who works for a nonprofit out here, Bruce Perry, who's a former land bank employee and Conservation Commission employee, and the incumbent John Stackpole. All the other races, there are nothing contested, although on the Historic District Commission, which has been a contentious board to sit on and to attend from time to time over the years, we'll see some new blood as incumbent David Barham has chosen not to seek re-election there.
One issue that we've covered, you've covered, I think all of us have covered at one point or another, is the cost of living on Nantucket. Now, town officials are trying to determine what you're calling the Nantucket factor when it comes to paying municipal employees. You can't, on Nantucket, you really can't get by on minimum wage or what folks are making you know, in other areas of the state.
No, not even close.
Not even close.
I think it's a fact of life for anyone that knows anything about the Cape and Islands, the islands, Nantucket in particular, that we're 30 miles out to sea, and 30 miles out to sea in a community that is relatively affluent, particularly in the summer, and it's a lot more expensive than living on the mainland. And the town municipal officials have found that retaining and attracting qualified employees to work for the town, just as the private sector has, is getting more and more difficult given the cost of living. They've commissioned a wage study. They're also looking to hire a consultant to try and figure out if there really is a Nantucket factor, and is that something that's driving away skilled professionals who can't necessarily afford to live here. They're looking for an economist to put a number or some kind of a scalable factor on what the Nantucket factor is and how it might apply to what kind of compensation might be paid. They say they're not necessarily averse, but a long way away from determining some kind of percentage that would be added to municipal salaries to attract employees. They are being very careful, however, to stress that this is for informational purposes only. In no way is it going to be set in stone or guide any kind of collective bargaining in the sense that it will be automatically added. It is just to give them some more information to sort of figure out exactly how much more it does cost to live here, whether it can be quantified, and move on from there. As the town moves forward, there are always some turnover in key spots, and in this technological age, it's getting a little more difficult to find skilled employees who can handle a town with a budget of well over $60 million is so self-contained with everything that goes on out here.
Sure. Makes sense. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. He's the director of digital content at the paper. You can follow him at JBallingIM. Josh, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, will join us. Welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Paul Pronovost, the editor of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Nelson Siegelman. He's the we're holding on for Nelson, and we expect him to join us fairly soon. Paul, let's talk about, there was an interesting story about the candidates lining up for the Cape Cod Commission seat. There's going to be an election there. A few little facts in there about who's not running again and who is.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, interesting that Bill Daugherty is not going to run. He's run forever. I mean, anyone who's been even closely associated with politics has seen Bill Daugherty. You know, whatever you think about his politics, and one thing about politicians, sometimes you like them, sometimes you don't.
Sure.
But you cannot quarrel with the guy's energy level. I mean, he is everywhere all the time, yeah. So it seems. So the notion that he's not going to run is a big change, will be a big change.
It was a shock to me to see that in this, just kind of there in the story. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he has been everywhere, and he has been controversial at times, that's for certain.
He certainly has. I mean, he's one of the folks who, on the Cape Cod Commission, is looking to get rid of the assembly as a unit and recreate county government. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about how county government should be framed. I mean, we currently sort of have an executive branch and a legislative branch, and then, of course, sort of a regulatory branch, if you will. And the notion is change could happen. And I think that's why this election could be pretty important. Bill leaving, several people lining up already to take his place. Leo Krikonis, who is currently an assembly member and has disagreed strongly with Bill Daugherty on this particular issue. He has already said that he's looking to run. Ed McManus, who is a selectman in Harwich, he is looking to run, and Ed has pointed out that, hey, he's been a town official for a very long time. He's already been standing in front of people addressing community needs, so he feels he's pretty well qualified. And then the third person who has lined up is Mark Forrest, who, as much as Bill Daugherty is known around here, so is Mark.
Sure.
Mark, of course, was Representative Studd's key aide here on the Cape and the Islands. He then became Bill Delahunt's chief of staff and had that job for years and years. He still works for Delahunt as part of the Delahunt Group, his consulting firm. But Mark has been known forever. I mean, he has been involved in politics from Provincetown to Bourne, issues throughout the Cape and the Islands. But he hasn't been an elected official. He's been a bureaucrat. And so it's an interesting transition. And I think this particular seat could be an interesting one for him. He very briefly ran for state senate. When Dan Wolf got in the race, I think several people, including Mark, sort of peeled off. But for the county commission, some folks thought that Mark, who lives in Yarmouth, might be a candidate for Cleon Turner's state representative position as Cleon is stepping down. But Mark feels that this position, the county commission, is well suited to his skills, and mm-hmm. he's going to give it a go.
Okay. Bourne, the town of Bourne, is again looking at cutting lifeguards, which has some folks in town saying, well, we're a coastal community here. We have beaches that people visit. Why are you cutting the lifeguards?
And beach fees. So I think that is, that, you know, to folks, they say, if my beach fee isn't going to pay for safety at the beaches, exactly what is it going to? And that's what people, you know, the crux of their argument. Of course, Bourne, like many communities, is struggling financially, and they are looking to trim costs anywhere they can. A couple years ago, they eliminated lifeguards. At first, they eliminated lifeguards at all their beaches, and then they realized maybe that was a little too dramatic. They brought some back. Now they're looking to cut what they have in place in half. So instead of four beaches, they're looking to simply staff two beaches. That would be a big change, though, and there are some folks who are already saying, bad idea, we're going to have to fight it. But we'll see how it plays out. Again, you know, Bourne, like any town, gets caught between a rock and a hard place, financially speaking. So sometimes you have to do something, and sometimes it's not popular.
And it's not only a safety issue, but some folks point out, look, you've got 28 young people here that you're employing right. over the summer. There's value in that.
Totally. And I, if Bourne did this, and we've discussed it back when this first happened, they'd be the only community on the Cape and the Islands that didn't employ lifeguards. It just seems like a natural for a coastal community that has beaches. Unless your coastline is only private beaches, it feels like there's some public safety responsibility to do it. And as a job creator, you know, pretty good job for young folks. So it's why you see it not only on the Cape and the Islands, but throughout coastal United States.
A sad news this week. Rex Peterson, who many of us knew as the Truro administrator, I think Wellfleet before that.
Yeah, assistant in Wellfleet. Yeah.
Assistant in Wellfleet passed away. On vacation.
This was a shocker,
yeah.
To be honest.
Awful.
I mean, anyone who has encountered Rex Peterson knew what a nice guy he was. Just a sweetheart. And he was known in the Outer Cape. Most recently, he was the town administrator in Truro, as you said. Before that, for a number of years, he was the assistant in Wellfleet. And before that, he worked in Eastham. And he had an architecture degree from Harvard. He put that to use in several community preservation efforts in and around the Outer Cape. And generally speaking, was just known as a very competent and caring town official. And it was a shock. He was on vacation in Florida. Seems he had a heart attack. And the word has bounced back to the Cape. And people just I can speak for myself. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I met Rex as part of the community leadership of Cape Cod a couple years ago. He was in the class. I was in the class. And he just had such a nice way about him and was so accessible and seemed, frankly, so laid back that you wouldn't think something like this would happen.
Yeah.
Adding to the tragedy is he had announced about a month ago that he was retiring in June. So he was stepping down at age 63, and he just didn't reach that point.
Yeah. Let's go to Nelson Siegelman. He's joining us on the phone. Of course, Nelson is the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Let's talk about what's happening at Martha's Vineyard Hospital. They're changing how the primary care doctors work there. Is that right?
Yes, this is an interesting program. It's called the Hospitalist Program, and it's in use in hospitals around the country. But this will be a first for Martha's Vineyard Hospital. And the change is designed to free up the primary care doctors. And really what this means is that in the past, primary care doctors admitted patients up to the floors. They went up on the floors. They dealt with the patients. And they were also responsible for releasing the patients. And this takes a lot of time away from their regular office hours and their regular clinic practices. The hospitalists are doctors who are assigned to the hospital floors. They deal only with inpatients. They follow up on tests. They make sure they discharge patients. So this program is designed to free up those primary care docs and also provide more follow-up and care for patients when they are, in fact, in their hospital rooms. And the hospital leadership's quite excited about it. It's a costly program. They estimate it will cost probably about $1 million. They'll be hiring three hospitalists and also physician's assistants to go along with that. So it's a big investment, but the hospital leadership said it's important for the community.
Mm. Talk about the stripers issue. I guess some fishermen on the island are saying, look, hold off on tightening the rules on stripers.
Well, yeah, not quite. The Division of Marine Fisheries had a hearing on Tuesday on Martha's Vineyard. It's one of three hearings they'll have this month about proposed rules changes to the striped bass commercial fishery. And even for people listening out there who may not like to fish, this is an important issue because, in fact, lots of people like to purchase striped bass in season. It's the signature New England game fish, but it's also a big deal on a lot of restaurant menus. But what's been happening in recent years is that there's been a glut of striped bass caught in a very short amount of time, and that closes the commercial season for mass fishermen. In fact, it was only open, I believe, about 18 days last summer. So these changes are designed to spread that out. But the part that I found interesting there during the hearing is that the commercial fishermen who attended, there were also conch fishermen, another big money fishery on the island. The fishermen all spoke in favor of more conservation efforts and more enforcement to make sure that the people who aren't playing by the rules do play by the rules. So we'll see what happens. The Division of Marine Fisheries will make a decision later in the probably by the spring in terms of how they're going to change these regulations. And what they may do is drop a fishing day or drop the bag limit for commercial fishermen. But it's all designed to spread out the season and also conserve the fishery.
Right. A nice, sweet little story in the paper this week that you're calling Wedding for Grandma. Tell us briefly, what's that about, Wedding for Grandma?
Well, you know, if the mountain won't come to Mohammed, Mohammed will go to the mountain. So in this case, Jade Bennett and Joseph Rock, two young people, they've been together a long time. They have two kids. They wanted to get married. And Jade's grandmother, she just recently went to the Windermere Nursing Home. Her name is Edith, and Edith was just not capable of going to the wedding. So the wedding came to Edith Bennett at the Windermere Nursing Home, and it was very nice. They set up a little room with decorations, and everybody was dressed to the nines, and they had this lovely wedding on Sunday at the Windermere Nursing Home, and the folks who... The wonderful staff at Windermere said that it was the first wedding that they can recall. So it's just a really nice story and certainly brightens up the winter days when you read something like that.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And folks can read that story and the other stories in more depth at the Martha's Vineyard Times website. Nelson Sigelman, of course, is the managing editor at the Times. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
Paul Pronovo is with me in our Woods Hole studio. Paul, let's quickly talk about these signs, these anti-President Obama signs that police say were burned, and they're investigating into what happened there. And the reason I bring this up is because they're so prominent. Many of us have seen them on Route 28 in Kituit as we passed by and kind of wondered what's going on there, because they're not small signs.
No, and the resident there has had them up for a long time, obviously in protest. Not a fan of President Obama's. If you look at those signs, I think one sign says something to the effect of I'm anti-Obama because he's anti-American or something to that effect.
Right.
And so, you know, of course, if you're going to make a strong statement like that, and he is certainly within his First Amendment rights to do so, you're going to get a reaction. And though I understand from our reporting that there was a camera set up to monitor the sign so no one could basically do what happened, because of the recent storms, the tree branches were down, covered in snow, covering the camera. Perfect opportunity for someone to do what they did, which was come up, most likely, as the fire department said, spray an accelerant on there and light them on fire. So the fire department was called to come deal with it. One of the signs was destroyed. One of them was just more singed. And I love how the fire department put it out. I mean, if you're going to put winter to use, this is the perfect way. They shoveled snow on the sign to put the fire out. Didn't even hook up to a hydrant.
Leave the hose alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Get a shovel. President Taft's, we haven't talked about President Taft on this show in many years.
How is that possible?
His steam-powered car has arrived on Cape Cod.
Yeah, a 1909 white steamer. And who knew that President Taft was the first president to say goodbye to the horse-drawn buggy and hello to an automobile, first presidential limo, if you will. And it's at the J.K. Lilly Automobile Museum at Heritage Plantation, which is just, frankly, just really cool to go check it out.
Oh, yeah, the museum is great. You know, what does it use for fuel?
It uses steam power, and
is it wood?
It's
wood.
It's wood, and it heats up water just like you'd be heating up a teapot, and it basically boils and fuels the automobile. And interestingly, at the time, there was, I guess, a debate. You know, what was going to be the fuel of choice for folks?
Yeah.
Gasoline, not nearly as readily available as, say, water. But ultimately, the fact that things like waiting 40 minutes for your car to warm up before you could actually power forward. That kind of slowed down the momentum of the steam-powered car. So out they went, in came gasoline, but Taft broke the mold in many ways with this automobile. And people can see it, presidential seal right on the side, a little rack in the back for President Taft and his wife to put a little blanket on them, because it is an open carriage automobile. And as anyone who's gone in there knows, one of many gorgeous, gorgeous cars.
Mm. It's a great story about Jay Leno with one of these cars driving down the highway in L.A. And I guess you can see the fire as it's creating
the
steam. And you have to actually accelerate to put the fire out. And some fire truck actually pulled Jay Leno over, thinking his vehicle was on fire.
No.
And he said, oh, no, this is how it's supposed to be. Real quick, there's been a cutout of who the next person to be the guest conductor.
Yes.
Tell us about that. And we filled in that cutout. Who is it going going to be?
Yeah, well, it's Charlie Rose, who is a PBS broadcaster and also on CBS This Morning on Sundays. Very well known, probably perfect for the Cape and Islands demographics. And he will be waving the baton as the guest conductor this summer for the Pops by the Sea. It was kind of fun. Kevin Howard of the Arts Foundation, there's always kind of a who's going to be the conductor, who's going to be the conductor. And he called us last week and said, let's do a little quiz. Let's have some fun with readers. And they gave away 50 free tickets for those who guessed, and it was kind of a fun thing building up to it. Charlie Rose.
Well, thank you, Paul Pronovo. I want to mention that coming up this Sunday on the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick's taking a look at this medical marijuana issue and what doctors in the area may or may not be writing prescriptions for the drugs. We heard about the Outer Cape, and that will have more about that. Also, you've heard about the WCAI Sunday screenings. Big screening coming up on Sunday. Come, go to our website to look at that. It's an Oscar winner and really interesting films about Alzheimer's disease. Not overwhelmingly sad, but really well-done films and a discussion following that. So go to our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Paul Pronovo for coming in today. Thanks for the other contributors, Tim Wood and Josh Balling and Sally Rose and Nelson Siegelman. And thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.